Breivik won't appeal after being jailed for up to 21 years for bomb and gun attacks in Norway last year. He was found sane and criminally responsible for the murders of 77 people by a court in Oslo. Before his address was cut short by the judge, Breivik apologised to militant nationalists for not killing more during last summer's attacks. His words are spoken by a translator.
In my view, this sentence and judgment is illegitimate. At the same time, I cannot appeal against the judgments because by appealing, I would legitimize the court.
New York City's mayor says some of the victims in the shooting outside the Empire State Building may have been hit by police bullets. 53-year-old Jeffrey Johnson shot dead a former colleague outside the building before firing into the street and at police. NYPD Commissioner Ray Kelly explains how the shooting unfolded.
Johnson had been employed for 6 years at Hazan Imports. About a year ago, Johnson was laid off. In a dispute with one of the former employees of Hazan, in front of the building, Johnson fired at close range.
A man who killed six people, including his wife and two young children in Jersey, have been found guilty of their manslaughter. Damien Chazowski went on the rampage with kitchen knives last summer after his wife confessed to an affair. Lance Armstrong is facing the prospect of being stripped of his seven Tour de France titles. He's dropped his fight against the drug-taking allegations from the US anti-doping agency, although he does maintain he's innocent. Prince Philip won't be attending the Paralympics opening ceremony next Wednesday while he continues to recover from a bladder infection. Around 2.3 million tickets have now been sold for the Games, and Catherine Jenkins has used Twitter to deny claims that she had an affair with David Beckham on Twitter. His spokesman says there was not a jot of truth in any of the online gossip. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Conservative Councillor for Avonmouth, Siobhan Kennedy Hall. Robin Clapp from the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance is here too. In the second hour after six, we go back to August 2010 and to Stockholm with the help of an Australian TV documentary which has examined the rape allegations against the man now famously stuck in Ecuador's Knightsbridge embassy, investigative journalist, whistleblower and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. The BBC refused to even name Assange's accusers, let alone asked what happened in Stockholm 2 years ago. Plus, Bradley Stoke has an election coming up, so we've invited three candidates to explain why you should vote for them. Also, employing thousands of disabled people since World War II, the coalition government's decided Remploy must close, throwing everybody on the dole and creating a much bigger bill for the taxpayer. We find out live what fate is befalling the Bristol workers. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 and a little rain. This weekend, highs of 20 Celsius, some heavy showers on Saturday, drier with some sunny spells on Sunday. Lighter showers on the bank holiday Monday. Next week, highs of 20 Celsius again, some sunny spells, but also showers this week. Next weekend, the 1st and 2nd of September, highs of 20 Celsius, all around about the same temperature for the next couple of weeks, isn't it? And sunny spells and showers, pretty much the same weather too. Not too much to remember there then, apart from that it looks a little bit better Sunday this weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, helping us review this week's news is Conservative Councillor for Avonmouth, Siobhan Kennedy Hall. Hi, Siobhan. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Now, what about your own position as a Conservative? You have chosen to join the Conservative Party. Why is that? Why not the Lib Dems? Why not Labour? Why not the Greens?
Well, I'm not beginning to question that now, but sometimes I do. I would like to think I'm more independent than actually aligned to any particular party. But it was particularly the Conservatives that I've been brought up with within my family environment. And I do and did believe in their morals and ethics. And I would just personally like to see them taking a harder stance these days.
Now, what about the central government? I mean, how happy are you as a local councillor with what Conservatives are up to in Westminster? Because we hear from many of all parties that they're not really, they don't actually agree with a lot of things that are going on in London.
It's not so much whether I agree with it or not. To be honest, I'm not a political animal. I was elected, in my opinion, to help the people. The politics is a side issue that's associated with being a local councillor.
OK, and what sort of committees are you on in the City Council?
Unfortunately, because of a change in jobs and being rather busy in my main role, at the moment I'm only on the Lower Severn Internal Drainage Board because the majority of the money comes from Avonmouth in relation to that. But it is actually a very good committee to be on, because otherwise we could end up completely flooded in Bristol. But also, in addition to that, community cohesion. I have previously been on sustainable development and transportation as
okay.
well.
OK, how do you keep the community together on community cohesion then?
Well, that's a very big question, but the main reasons, the main crux behind it is actually to get people talking and to make people realise that it doesn't matter whether you're Polish, English, British, whatever you want to be, we're all human beings and we're all living in the same city, and it's important for us all to actually get on. And yes, this ties in quite nicely with the big society and with everybody going back to looking after each other in their own neighbourhood.
What about your work outside the council then?
Well, I currently work for a rather large facilities management company, which is a Bristol-based company.
What does that mean, facilities management? What facilities do you manage?
OK, well, particularly within my division, we deal with waste and environmental services. So I'm doing what I've always done for the last 20 years. I'm looking after the environment and making sure that stuff doesn't get thrown away, but actually gets dealt with in the best manner and wherever possible is recycled.
What about some of the big issues that are being dealt with nationally by the Conservatives? One is, you know, comes to mind immediately, is the health service. It does seem that the changes that are being made to the health services are basically a top-down reorganisation. This is not what we were promised before the last general election, is it?
No, absolutely not. But to be honest, a lot of it makes financial sense. By outsourcing, you can actually ensure that you've got service level agreements and key performance indicators. That means that you actually get what you're paying for. And you get the service that's meant to be being provided.
OK, we're also joined by Robin Clapp from the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Tony.
Now, what about your views this week on the announcement we had from George Osborne? George didn't even actually make the announcement. It was Office of Budget Responsibility that we're borrowing another £600 billion. And this is just July. We're supposed to be getting the books a bit better, aren't we, at the moment? That doesn't seem to be happening.
No, George has had a few headaches over the last few weeks, and the Olympics were perhaps a little distraction for him, but now it's back to earth with a bump, because we're borrowing more. Manufacturing industry isn't recovering. There was an item in the press today saying that the government's much-vaunted quantitative easing programme has ended up with 75% of the money created going to the top 25% of earners in this country. So there isn't money in people's pockets, and I think the government is now facing the very real possibility of the double dip getting worse in the third quarter. And I notice there's a lot of speculation beginning on the back benches of the Tory party about whether in the new reshuffle that Cameron is talking about, George Osborne might be moved. Personally, I don't think Cameron can afford to move him, because it would be an admittance of failure on Cameron's part.
Well, but sorry, I just had to interrupt you, because I said £600 billion. It's £600 million extra borrowed back in July. Siobhan, this is not looking good, is it? The government policy is to cut in order to balance the books. What's happening is, as a result, there's less and less coming in tax, and so George Osborne is having to borrow more and more all the time. Looks like we're going down the route of Greece if we're not careful. Ben Chu in The Independent on Wednesday says another disastrous month and George Osborne is forced to cut deeper.
Well, yes, and unfortunately there are a lot of plans being put in place that take a long time to actually happen.
They've had 2 years now.
Yes, I know. Okay, fair enough. I can't really defend that at all, can I? I think what we need to be looking at as well is actually looking at business and ensuring that they are actually paying the taxes they should be paying and stop all the loopholes. Because if we were actually earning the money back from the business and in relation to the taxes that they're meant to be paying, then we shouldn't have to be borrowing as much as we are.
Robin, what are your thoughts then on this news? Because we are really, I mean, it does seem now that there's less and less tax coming in as a result of the cuts, and the answer is supposed to be George Osborne is going to be cutting deeper. That means there's going to be less tax coming in. I mean, surely the only thing to do is to actually try and get some of the wealth from foreign offshore accounts and this kind of thing. Tax havens seems to be the only way to actually find money to spend at the moment.
Well, 2 years ago, the Civil Service Trade Union PCS did an investigation that showed that over £120 billion is uncollected each year from big companies that deliberately take their tax out of Britain into offshore accounts. I think as well, it's been acknowledged in the last couple of months that there now exist £750 billion lying idle in the coffers of the big companies that can't see any investment opportunities over the next few years. And so therefore we have almost £1 trillion lying idle in this country. And as you say, Tony, if you add to that figure the vast amount of tax that has disappeared as a result of people not having work and not paying tax, then it's a calamity for the Conservatives. And the reality is, if you don't actually stimulate investment, you don't find ways of giving investment to small businesses in particular, which are screaming out to the Tories for help at the present time, then you will have the seizing up of the economy. And that's largely what we're seeing. And small business after small business is going bankrupt because the money is not reaching them. And also, there is not the demand in the economy, because if people are worried about their jobs, they're worried about their mortgages, they're worried about their futures, they're less likely to go out and buy that new car or that new house or whatever it might be. And so therefore, what I see ahead is a continuation of the double dip. And some economists are saying it will be 20 years before Britain gets back to the level of economic performance it had in 2008. The Tories themselves have warned it will be 2020 before we see an upturn in Britain.
Okay,
of any size.
Siobhan, what are your thoughts about that? That's a long time to wait, isn't it?
No, it is a long time to wait, but don't you think that it's about time we got away from being a society that just spends money and buys things constantly? You know, you need to go back to the days where we were actually Great Britain and had factories that produced, that we sold the goods abroad, that we earned our money that way.
But I mean, how are we going to build these factories if the banks won't loan and the government is cutting all the time?
Well, it's exactly as has just been said. We need to get that money in that is being stuck across in other countries as tax havens.
Okay, another discussion this week has been about quantitative easing. This is Ben Chew again, actually, one of my favourites is in The Independent. Bank's stimulus plan has lined the pockets of the rich. The Bank of England's money printing programme, intended to revive economic growth, has delivered a massive boost to the wealth of the most prosperous 10% of households in Britain, while delivering relatively scant returns for the poorest. A new analysis from the bank indicated yesterday. Its report on the effectiveness of QE program said it successfully pushed up share prices and other asset values, delivering an overall boost to the net financial worth of UK households of around £600 billion. The bank said this worked out an average benefit of around £10,000 per person. However, big however here, financial assets are unevenly distributed around the population, meaning the benefit was highly unequal. Analysis by The Independent reveals the wealthiest 10% of households would have benefited from quantitative easing more than 240 times as much as the poorest 10%. Well, this seems like perfect from sort of policy from the millionaire's cabinet, Siobhan.
Thank you for that comment there, Tony. I don't know about you. I don't own a single share. So I certainly haven't benefited from it. And it's another situation where the money is going to the wrong people. But it comes back to businesses. Businesses shouldn't just be trying to make as much profit as possible to pay out as many dividends as possible to shareholders. They should actually be looking at putting that money back into the country for the good of the country, not just a select few who own their shares.
Well, George Osborne's reaction this week was rather muted. He didn't seem to say anything about the £600 million extra borrowed. But they did manage to find somebody called Chloe Smith, who is a Treasury Minister I'd not heard of before. So although we didn't get George Osborne's reaction, we did get hers, and this is what she had to say.
There is no easy or quick solution to this. What is needed is the kind of practical action that this government has been able to take, which is about getting, for example, funding for lending through to businesses or indeed helping households, and crucially, the kind of responsible action we've taken to deal with our debts.
Well, Chloe Smith would say that, but the reality is that the small businesses are screaming to the government for aid. It's not coming from the government. Quantitative easing has panned out exactly how many people, including myself, thought it would. It's not reaching people's pockets. It's not reaching businesses. And consequently, there is no stimulus. There is no demand in the economy. And once again, we have, you know, Chloe Smith telling the old lie that the deficit has been brought about as a result of overspending by the last government. The truth is the deficit was created largely as a result of letting unaccountable bankers run riot during the 1990s in the first years of this century, using pretend money to make wealth that they thought would line their pockets. We're paying the consequence of their mistakes, and the liberalisation of the economy is something that didn't begin under Gordon Brown. I've got no time for New Labour's policy, let me make that clear. But New Labour happened to be the party in government in 2008 which had to pick up the mess that had been accumulating for 20 years. We're going to spend the next 20 years actually trying to deal with that mess. And in that context, given the international situation as well, there is no way that the coalition's policies will get Britain out of recession. And it's now a moot point as to how soon it will be before the credit ratings agencies actually begin to downgrade Britain's credit as well. It's got a AAA rating at the moment, but there are murmurs coming from all the credit ratings that it's not going to get better in Britain.
That's very, very true. A stance has to be made. But I mean, out of interest, who would you actually blame for the lack of regulation of the bankers back in the 90s?
Well, I would blame the bankers for actually using their money to lobby against regulation. In fact, during the New Labour time and the Conservative governments, there's been general reining back of regulation of the banks. So the banks themselves are to blame because they've got too much money. They can do virtually what they want with it.
Absolutely. And now what are they looking to do to us? They're looking to actually charge us to have bank
accounts. That's right. That's our next story.
People are going to start sticking their money back under the mattress, if
banks
you ask
are
me.
To use, as Siobhan sort of pointed out there, so to use their LIBOR parliamentary probe to push for the end of free accounts. And this is banks plotting is the word, this must be the Daily Mail, to use a parliamentary inquiry into their bad behaviour as a way of imposing account fees on customers. MPs and peers on a commission set up to examine the recent LIBOR scandal will be approached by financial institutions this week, which will argue in favour of introducing current account charges. Robin?
Well, it's a no-win situation for ordinary people, isn't it? If you take your money out of the banks and you leave it under your bed, the insurance companies will probably put your premiums up because they'll say that if you get robbed, then you're going to claim for more. It's outrageous that
well,
banks
Sir Robin,
are charging
Sir David Walker, Barclays' new chairman, said after Marcus Aegeus, departure of him, who's also, by the way, a trustee of the BBC, incredibly, he said the scandals were a consequence of not charging for bank accounts. And in principle, he agreed with charging fees.
Well, you know, that shows just how out of touch these people are. The opening up of the economy, the allowing of the bankers to do what they wanted, began with the political decisions that were made in the 1980s by the Margaret Thatcher government, the liberalisation of financial services, the freeing of credit controls, the opening up of the world economy to the domination of finance.
But and when Labour got in, Robin, in 1997,
exactly
they did exactly
the same. Absolutely, they're all in it together. They are all in it together. The establishment politicians all sang from the same hymn sheet. While the bankers were bringing home the money, they all preferred to turn their eyes away from the deficit and the crisis that was brewing. And those of us like myself and many, many others who saw that you could not sustain an economy on fictitious finance have been proven correct, and it doesn't make us happy for one moment to be proven
correct.
Okay,
so what can we do, Robin?
Well, for a start, we can get some of these bankers who fiddled billions where they belong, out of positions of authority and behind bars. Well, because if I behave like they would, I'd be in prison.
Siobhan, it does seem a little bit cheeky. Bankers have actually thieved billions of pounds and dollars during this LIBOR scheme, and they're now saying that actually you should give us a little bit more.
Yeah, which is completely wrong. Banks are there as custodians of the money, and they make their money from the money that's in the bank accounts. It's not fair to then charge us to put our money into the bank account. Now, the problem we've got is that in this day and age, more and more payments are being dealt with electronically. You can't not have a bank account. You're also using it as a method of ID. I mean, you know, people on low incomes cannot afford to get passports. The cost of obtaining a passport these days is astronomical. I mean, you even go to your doctor to have your doctor sign the photograph, it costs you another £20-25. I would just like to say here and now, I do it for my constituents free of charge, as long as I have known them for the requisite time. But, you know, it's a ridiculous situation where, yet again, the rich are getting richer. But it's not just the rich. It's the people that have absolutely, completely and utterly abused every system that they possibly can, with no thought for anyone other than themselves.
OK, and another story to do relating to the finances. Lord Rothschild this week has taken a £130 million bet. Well, it's nice if you can bet £130 million on something against the euro. This is Jacob Rothschild. He's taken a near £130 million bet against the euro. As fears continue to grow, the single currency will break up. A member of the banking dynasty has taken the position through RIT Capital Partners, the £1.9 billion investment pound investment trust, of which he is executive chairman. Robin?
Well, I think the canny Lord Rothschild is on to a winner there, because it's very likely that the euro in its present form will break up. I think it's a question of when rather than if. We have a lot of huffing and puffing from all the European Union bureaucrats saying they would do everything to sustain the euro, but it's quite evident that you cannot continually force the poverty levels upon the Greek workers that have been forced on them in the last 3 or 4 years. The Greek economy fell by another 6% in the last quarter. It's unsustainable to carry on with a single currency where the southern European countries are losing out, and where the German economy is getting, relatively speaking, a very good deal out of the euro, because their higher productivity means they can sell their goods more cheaply. But of course, for the German people as well, there's the question of, well, how many more bailouts are they prepared to tolerate their government giving to southern Europe? It's going to end in tears, as many of us predicted would be the case when it was first begun.
Now, Siobhan, he's a local boy, Jacob Rothschild, at least one of his pads, anyhow, is down in Wiltshire near Pusey. Is it right that people should be betting these vast sums on these kind of on this outcome? Because, of course, you know, being a powerful banker himself, surely he has actually some influence over the outcome here.
Yes, I mean, he is actually using his position to sway what's going to happen, which is absolutely wrong. But I would like to point out, it's not just Greece. We keep seeming to forget the rest of Europe that is in financial difficulties. We've got Portugal, we've got Spain, France are in a very dodgy situation and position at the moment as well. And what I don't understand is why actually, as a country, we're not standing up and being so proud of the fact that we refused to join the euro, and continually said that we wouldn't join the eurozone. We have done the right thing as a country, yeah, and we ought to actually be proud of that.
Well, I think a lot of people are, but the only trouble is, of course, if the eurozone goes down, that may well bring the city down too, simply because of the interconnected loans.
But that's the problem. Why should we be responsible for the rest of Europe when we are not part of that eurozone?
It's called the EU.
Yes, anyway, I know, but that brings us to another conversation,
well,
doesn't it?
Which also,
I don't agree with.
And also the getting rid of these barriers to money in the beginning of the Thatcher years. Mm. People used to not be able to move money around the world as they can now, and that was one of the first things that happened with the single market program in Europe, that money could be moved around much more easily.
Yes,
so,
but don't you think that that's actually been part of the cause of the problems that we're now in, by being able to move money more easily?
Undoubtedly it has been, but it was Margaret Thatcher who was very zealous in doing that, because it was all about, in those days, getting rid of restraints on free trade and allowing globalisation to have its head. And here we are today, 25 years later, with the result that all the countries in Europe, to a lesser or greater degree, are being strangled by lack of demand, by massive cuts. And the question is, for Britain, 50% of our exports go to Europe. Gone are the days when we could say wistfully, well, let's trade with Australia and New Zealand and Canada. Those days have gone. Europe is where Britain is, and Britain is suffering the contagion from the euro, but is also to a large extent responsible for the debacle in terms of having gone along with and been the pioneer of this neoliberal globalised system that is responsible responsible for it all?
Well, we did actually have some very good exports to China as well, but they've had a downturn in their market, so we're losing the ability to export and sell to them.
Okay, looking ahead to next month, Wednesday, September the 12th, well, nearly September the 11th, not quite, the day after, a bit spooky that, but the Angela Merkel is saying that the 14th of September, this, the 12th is the date of this court decision in Germany about whether what their parliament has decided is lawful or not. Now, that's a bit awkward for the Germans, for Merkel particularly, because she's saying that the German parliament have decided whether or not they will go along with this new bailout fund. But then that has to be tested in the German courts to see if it's legal, even though it's been put there by the lawmakers. So, bit of a weird one, this. But that, so that's all happening on the 12th. But on the 14th, that could be the crucial date, apparently. That's the day when Eurozone finance ministers and central bankers are due in Cyprus to discuss the crisis. Now, I'm going to ask you both, what do you think is going to happen? Middle of Europe, is that going to be it for the euro, or is it going to be able to live its zombie life another day, Siobhan?
I have no idea is the absolutely truthful answer to that one. Who knows? I'm just going to wait and see what actually happens.
Okay, Robin?
I think the Troika, the European Commission, the IMF and the Eurocrats in Brussels will do everything they can to try and put yet another sticking plaster over this bleeding corpse, but I think that the euro will go down. And I agree with Siobhan, Spain, Portugal, other countries as well are in an unsustainable position. In some ways, for a country like Spain with a big economy, the pain would be less being outside of the euro and being able to trade with the peseta and use the lower value of the peseta to export than carrying on with an overinflated currency that is strangulation by a thousand thousand sort of cuts, and I don't think it will last. It's a question of when, in my view, not rather than if.
Okay, and of course, just a little reminder that Lord Rothschild has taken a $130 million bet.
It used to be called insider trading.
Well, yes, I'd like to think it was his own money, but certainly isn't, is it?
Okay, now on to a little debacle down in Portishead and South Somerset. Portishead Conservative councillor has labelled the party untrustworthy. This is reported by the BBC, but we still haven't seen a squeak about it in the Evening Post, unless it's possibly into today's post. The Conservative Party should not be trusted by voters, according to a Tory councillor in North Somerset. In an email sent by Councillor Don Cameron, Portishead Town Council, he's also from Cameron Balloons, the Conservative Party has been accused of corrupt practice. It follows a row over the purchase of a minibus and an office rental in Nailsea, which led to disciplinary action. Now, Siobhan, what are your thoughts about this? I mean, basically, he's spelling out here, Don Cameron, that the Conservatives' internal disciplinary procedures managed from central office are simply not fair. These two members of the association who were running it have basically been told, we're going to run it now centrally from central office. But the thing is, they're being accused of some really rather minor things. So what are your thoughts about how your party runs its own disciplinary procedures?
It's difficult. I mean, if I compare it to my work environment as well, what I do find these days is that it's virtually impossible to discipline people effectively. You have to jump through so many hoops. You have to ensure that you do everything to the letter. And I've recently been dealing with a number of claims that have been made against my company, and they're actually spurious. But the hours that it's taking us to undertake the paperwork to prove our innocence is costing the company greatly. And I think we ought to be looking at things on a political, local basis in the locality. Why should we have the main party back in London dictating? I'm not saying we shouldn't be going through the processes and procedures that are set in stone for doing that, but it seems that we're just being a bit heavy-handed here. But I'd also question Don Cameron actually coming out and saying what he did in the way that he did. I know personally, sometimes I come out with things, and my colleagues would certainly agree with this, in really the wrong way. But I do then put my hands up and admit to it. But this is very damaging.
To be fair, this is leaked. I mean, he did only send it to the members of that association, but this email's been leaked.
Maybe he shouldn't have put it in writing. Maybe he should have actually had a conversation with them first.
Well, I mean, I'm sure Don's argument would be that they've been saying this for months and months and there's been no action, so he's felt he needs to do this. Now, Robin, what's one of the main problems, apparently, is that the buying of a minibus in 2010 for £5,000, which later developed faults and was sold at a loss of £3,500. This was Liam Fox's campaign minibus. So, I mean, at the end of the day, is that really worthy of some kind of intervention and taking over the local party by central office?
Well, obviously, someone's stood on Don Cameron's corns and he's very upset about the matter. It's not a story that bothers me. If the Tories want to fall out and make public what many millions of people think in this country, that their party isn't fit to govern, then all power to Don Cameron's elbow. As someone who was threatened with expulsion from the Labour Party once for being a socialist, I have no trust or conviction in any of the main party's disciplinary procedures.
And what about just the general democracy of political parties? So certainly one of the things that keeps cropping up on this show is that they quite often seem to ignore the actual policies that the members want them to put into place, and they seem to be rather more top-down than bottom-up.
Well, I think for the Conservative Party, there are lots of members who would, you know, welcome a return to the hang 'em and flog 'em days. But of course, the coalition restraints make that difficult. So Cameron has to be careful. But, you know, I was in the Labour Party for a number of years before the Labour Party left me. I eventually left when it stopped being a socialist party and started jailing people for non-payment of the poor tax in Bristol. Elderly people, pensioners, people of that ilk. I think all parties are out of touch with their rank and file, and the most astonishing thing is how few people take the trouble to join a mainstream political party these days. Why? Because they all say the same thing. They all are men or women in grey suits. They all talk over the heads of ordinary people. And when you have local councillors or local MPs who actually stand up and support their constituents or actually go out of the way to listen to their constituents, they are very much the exception rather than the rule these days. That's why people aren't engaged with politics, not because they don't feel passionately about issues, but because the people very often in the political parties are place seekers who are using a political party as a career rather than a place to make real reforms.
Now, Siobhan, you're a Conservative councillor. One of the things that Don Cameron says is there is something rotten at the centre of the Conservative Party, he writes, and we can never be deserving of the electorate's confidence while this persists. That's pretty strong words.
It's extremely strong, and I think on a looking at an issue where a minibus was bought for £5,000 but it developed faults and was sold at a loss for £3,500, maybe that loss would have been greater if they'd actually tried to do any work to it and tried to make it work. We don't know all the facts here, and it just seems very, very heavy-handed to turn around and say that there's complete corruption within the party. To be honest, if there is corruption and he's aware of it, he needs to actually name names and he needs to give the evidence. Maybe that's what he's been trying to do.
Well, BBC haven't put all of the letter on the internet, but I have. So if you want to, you can have a look through later at that evidence. And it's pretty damning stuff, I can tell you. On to our next story. And a new police role in the elections is wrong. This is in Wednesday's Post. The election of Avon and Somerset's first police commissioner is perverse and undemocratic, ministers have been told. In a new blow to the controversial reforms, that is the Police and Crime Commissioner introduction, the election which is happening in November, independent candidates have said that they have no chance of getting their message across because they're not allowed a free mail shot. Voters will go to the polls to elect a new Police and Crime Commissioner on November the 15th, the same day as the Bristol Mayor election. And even in Somerset, no independent candidates so far put themselves forwards. Yesterday, a letter was handed to Downing Street complaining about the decision not to give every candidate a free or mail shot. What do you think about this one, Siobhan? Do you think they should get a free mail shot to get their word out to voters?
Personally, no. Sorry, I don't. Do you know how many of these mail shots are just completely ignored and go straight into the recycling? Hundreds upon thousands. Seriously, I've seen it. I've seen it when I was doing my election campaigning, and unfortunately I'm going to see it again next year.
Do you think there's any enthusiasm for the Police and Crime Commissioner election?
No, I don't think anybody understands it. I don't think they understand why we're looking at putting in a police commissioner. But I certainly don't think that independents or party aligned commissioners or candidates rather should actually be given a free mail shot. If they want to promote themselves, then why aren't they getting out there? Now, I could sit here and start doing some campaigning on behalf of the Conservative candidate, and I'm not going to, because I think that's unfair, because it would be biased of me and I would be giving only one side of the story. But, you know, our candidate is out there. He is going to meetings. He is going to events locally. He is talking to the people. That's how you actually get your message across, by dealing with the people. We're talking local politics here.
But, I mean, this is the way to get something through everybody's doorsteps. I mean, people aren't necessarily going to give up their evening to go to some public meeting somewhere to meet someone.
Oh, I'm not talking about public meetings. I'm talking about going to things that are actually on, in the local areas. So going to things like the Party in the Park in Avonmouth, going to the BMX events down at Lawrence Weston, all of those sorts of things, actually getting out and dealing with the people. So it's not about trying to drag people out of their comfort zone on the sofa in front of the TV with their microwave meal on the lap. It's about actually putting yourself out there where the people already are.
Okay, what about the principal? Is it a good idea to get rid of the old police authority, which is made up of something like a dozen members, from some lay members, some from the different local authorities represented by Avon and Somerset Police?
I don't think it's a bad idea, no. I think it should hopefully give us more accountability and more cohesion as well.
Well, we'll certainly know who to point the finger at, won't
Absolutely.
We, if things go wrong. Robin?
Not convinced by this at all. I think we're taking the American road. We're having an election, yet we're not talking here about a ward election. I would agree with Siobhan that if you were standing as a candidate in Avonmouth, it's sufficient to go to local areas to intervene in local community and so on. We're talking here about a city-wide role. So the question for me is, what role democracy? If we're saying that this is an elected position for the whole of Avon and Somerset, it's very, very difficult for one candidate, even one of the mainstream party candidates, to go to all those meetings and all those places and shake all those hands of all those people across the entire area. So if we're saying that only the big parties will in effect be able to do that because they will have the money to produce their own leaflets, we're saying that no small party or no small individual, no independent who may have some really good ideas, will easily be able to use their voice. Because let's be quite honest, they're not going to get mainstream television coverage. And so therefore, I think that the same rules should apply for all the candidates. But I agree, I don't think this is in people's minds as an election that is going to be a must go out and vote election. It's part of a larger tired approach that people have towards elections now, and that is because very often the issues are not explained. We've got to find new and inventive ways of engaging with people. That might mean, you know, the internet and all sorts of issues to get young people involved. But above all, the last time I had a politician knocking on my doorstep canvassing me, I can't remember the last time, because truthfully, very few of the politicians, Siobhan may be an exception, but very few of the politicians now bother, certainly the New Labour ones I've known in the past, bother to go on the doorsteps canvassing, because they take voters for granted, and that's the problem. People don't want to be taken for granted anymore.
Siobhan, this is something that we've not been given a referendum on like we were with the mayor, isn't it? We've just been told, you've got to do this. Is it any surprise that people aren't particularly enthusiastic about it, and also that there may be a very low turnout?
Absolutely. But then again, it is being done on the same day as the Bristol mayoral election. So hopefully the turnout will be quite good. Interestingly enough, whenever there's a national election on the same day as a local election, then obviously we get a higher turnout. But I mean, I have to say, I do door knock, and I go against what my party says. I will not just do the pleasantries. If people want to talk to me and they want me to stand there for 15 minutes whilst they tell me their problems, I stay there. It may mean that the rest of the volunteers get really cheesed off with me, but that's what I'm there for. I'm actually there to listen to the people and help them. And I certainly have had the blisters many a time to prove it. But, you know, let's put it this way. If somebody really wants something, be it to become a councillor, be it to be the police commissioner, then surely they should put the effort in, whether it's aligned to a party or whether it's an independent. I'm sorry, there is no such thing as a free lunch. There never has been and there never will be. If you want something in this world, you have to put in the effort.
Well, you talked there about door knocking, Siobhan. Robin was talking about handshaking. And this is a perfect link into the next story, which is about Freemasons, because like a bad smell, this lingers on. I'm talking about the matter of Filton and Bradley Stoke MP Jack Lopresti's live promise back in May on this show to supply me with a copy of the Bristol Freemasons annual provincial yearbook with the names of Bristol's 2,000 or so Freemasons in the city's 50 or so lodges based at their anonymous temple at the bottom of Park Street. Well, you might say this is a one-off, but as far as I can see, Freemasonry seems to be all about broken promises. Now, Bristol's Provincial Grand Secretary, Steve Rawlings, has also promised me the book 2 weeks ago and has still failed to deliver. And since he made the promise, he won't even return phone calls. Well, not much of a much of a deal there, is there? So anyway, what is Freemasonry? I spoke last year to someone called Martin Short, who wrote a book called Inside the Brotherhood, and I'll be asking my guests what their thoughts are on the craft after we've had a listen to this.
Much is made of the fact Rudyard Kipling and his lodge in India was ecumenical. People from any religion could join. You know, Christian, Muslim, Jew, Sikh, you know, Zoroastrian, anyway. Anyone who believed in a single god, you see, the only stipulation was it should be monotheistic. But once you get above the third degree, it's all Christian in a kind of perverse form. It's all fictive. It's all a miasma of legend and lies, you know. And it's like a pyramid sales operation, Freemasonry, because you have to keep on going up all these ranks in the hope that one day you will find the secret, the absolute kernel secret of Freemasonry. But as we've seen, they change the actual, magic word. The words that you're told up to a certain level are the secret words of the signs of Freemasonry. You're told, oh, no, it's not like that at all. You know, you've been led down the garden path. I mean, it is a bit like a pyramid sales operation. And, of course, it does cost you a huge amount of money.
That's Martin Short there, the author of Inside the Brotherhood. Now, Robin, what do you think about this? Because, I mean, surely this is a simple matter of declaration of interest, really. We should know who are Freemasons in Bristol so that we know who are councillors, council officers and other people of power and importance wielding money, the public money, this kind of thing, who they are.
Absolutely. And the fact that they have verbally given you an assurance that they will produce the booklet but have signally failed to do so will be an embarrassment to them, or should be an embarrassment to them, because people will say, well, what have you got to hide then? In truth, organisations like the Freemasons, the Society of Merchant Venturers, who are, in some people's minds, the people who really own and control Bristol, they certainly own most of central Bristol, these organisations are very shadowy organisations, and you know, my colleague said just now there's no such thing as a free lunch. I think there's a free lunch for a lot of these people. I think the odd handshake gives you access to many places that ordinary mortals like me wouldn't easily get into. So, yes, let's see the book. If they've nothing to hide, if they are really a charitable foundation that do good deeds for the people of Bristol, what have they got to hide?
And Siobhan, what's your thoughts on this? I mean, like I say at the beginning, it seems to me that this is a simple matter of declaration of interest. If you're a member of a secret society, particularly a Masonic society, shouldn't you be declaring that? Shouldn't that be down there when in your declaration of interest as a councillor or even for council officers, for anyone that's wielding power in the city?
Personally, yes, I think so. To be honest, as a woman, I'm not entitled to become a Freemason.
Well, you can in Gloucestershire. If you want to,
I'm in the city of Bristol.
If you're a woman and you ask to join the Masons here in Bristol, you're told, well, you can go down to Chipping Sodbury.
Oh, well, how kind of them. I mean, to be honest, all I know about Freemasons is, as has been said, it does cost an awful lot of money to be a Freemason. My father, as a general practitioner, was invited to become a Freemason. Unfortunately, he's been dead for some years now. But, you know, it was very much an elite sort of society many years ago. But as a woman, I have very little knowledge of it, no interaction with it. And yes, it's always just known as the Society of Funny Handshakes, with one trouser leg rolled up and you shake hands under your left leg or something along those lines. But they are doing things that are for the benefit of the city or otherwise, then yes, they should be declaring that they are a member or they are a Freemason.
For example, there's a potential for, I mean, we know that George Ferguson, who's standing for mayor, is a merchant venturer, but there's a potential that one of the people standing for police and crime commissioner or mayor could be a Freemason, and we wouldn't necessarily know about it.
But do we actually think that they go around and do things behind everybody's back and they get things done that wouldn't get done otherwise?
Well, I mean,
I don't know.
Certainly, I think they do. I mean, they're in a situation where they have secret liaisons with various other people in their lodge. As I was saying, we've got something like 2,000 Masons in Bristol and 50 or so lodges here. Each one is a sort of little self-contained unit, and nobody outside that organisation knows who they are.
Well, it clearly is the case that they have some influence, and that influence may on occasions be positive, it may on occasions be very negative. People wouldn't join them if there was no purpose to it, and if there was nothing to be got from it. It's not only prestige. If it were prestige, people would be proud to say, I am a Freemason. The fact that there's such secrecy about who the Masons are and so on indicates that there's a lot more. It's like the Society of Merchant Venturers. I believe they have in Bristol only one woman member. They made Margaret Thatcher an honorary member in the 1980s. But, you know, any organisation which in the 21st century say that half the population not even eligible to join is an organisation that I don't think any ordinary person would want to belong to anyway. But it's not about, you know, whether they're harmless individuals, cranks, or go around with their trouser legs rolled up. It's what influence they have on elected politicians, what influence they have behind the scenes. How many of them are magistrates? How many of them, through the old boys network, and I use the old boys deliberately, really are able to, for instance, gain contracts for work in the city that would otherwise not be made available to other people. I know, as someone who's worked in specific fields, that often with the issuing of contracts, no matter what rigorous procedures you have on paper, a little word in the ear can go a long way in order to get that contract to the person who wants it. So, let you know, come clean on all this, say who you are, and if your organisation is so wonderful, I'm sure you want to get more members. In that case, go public and let us all sign up.
But if that's what's happening, that is corruption. You know, contracts should not be given out just on the say-so of somebody else. But it does make me think a little bit of the working men's clubs when, you know, they were the enclave of just men and the women weren't allowed in and it was all boys together. And to be honest, that's the sort of image I have of it. But if there's corruption going on, then we need to know who's involved.
Okay, well, maybe the working men's clubs were a sort of reaction to the Freemasonry of its day. Anyhow, not a million miles away, now we talk about the Knights Templar, because this is what Anders Breivik, who's been sentenced today to 21 plus years in jail over in Norway, that's what he said he was. And we're going to have a listen now to Torstein Vidal, who's a Norwegian reporter, who's explained to me a few months ago what he thinks the connections are between Breivik and the UK.
I read from the website document.no, which is a far-right pro-Israel website, that Anders had been complicit in constructing the ideological fundament for English Defence League and Norwegian Defence League. So he's been participating in finding out what kind of group they were supposed to be and what kind of values they were supposed to fight for. And yeah.
Well, that's pretty worrying. Robin, this is something which has come out. I mean, actually, the Daily Telegraph has done probably the best investigation of this just a few months or weeks after the attacks at Utøya, where 77 people were shot dead, most of them young Labour Party of Norway supporters. But these links to the English Defence League seem pretty clear. I mean, that was also said in Breivik's manifesto, 3,000 page manifesto that he wrote and put out. What are your thoughts about who this guy was now he's been finally sentenced?
Well, first of all, I think every rational person in the world was shocked to their foundations by this massacre. And there is an outcome presently where this guy has been sentenced to a minimum of 21 years, as I understand it. And I think everyone would applaud that. Personally, you know, I would throw the keys away. I don't think someone can ever be allowed out into society who's not only done something like that, but still to this day claims he's doing it for political principles. His links with the EDL have been flagged up on many occasions. I think that organisation itself is an organisation that is still in this country allowed to create chaos in cities and towns with its demonstrations and everything else. I think there needs to be a lot more investigation into who is funding the EDL. The far right in this country have one aim, and that is to divide people, to create a lack of cohesion within communities, and to have people fighting each other. And, you know, when it's taken to an extreme, as in the case of Breivik, then you actually have the idea that these people can go around and shoot their way to their political aims. And, you know, as I say, the newspapers in this country and the researchers who are trying to find those links, if those links are proven, then the government should think long and hard about what kind of organisation this is. But more importantly, where is it getting its funding from?
Now, the police over in Norway were trying to say that, in fact, the prosecutors were saying that they actually were encouraging the idea that he was insane, and that doesn't seem was the case. They've now today said he certainly wasn't insane. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, on one level, people would scratch their heads and say it is insane to just indiscriminately kill so many young people. But I don't think he was insane. I think he was actually radicalized, if you can use that word, with the idea that he was making a statement on behalf of the far right internationally, that he would, if necessary, be prepared to be a martyr for the cause. And the cause was the eradication of a number of young people to show the supremacy of the Aryan race, which is, again, you know, going back to the kind of frightening language we heard in the 1930s and have continued to hear from time to time ever since. But of course, this idea that somehow the Norwegians can deal with people who are not pure Norwegians or are not patriots by using guns and all the rest of it is so far beyond most normal people's perception that it would be understandable people would say he was mad. But he's not mad. He's motivated by an idea of white supremacy. And like all white supremacists, as we saw in the US in the 1960s with the Ku Klux Klan and many other such organizations, when they actually think they are right, they will use whatever methods they can, and we end up with the devastation that we've got in Norway. And our hearts go out to everyone and his families who are having to relive this at the present time. But if there's any solace to be got, it's in the hope that this guy will never be allowed out into civilized society. But we also have to see where his roots are. Where does this organization come from? What are its international links? And those have to be dealt with forcibly.
Well, the Telegraph article talks about a guy called Paul Ray, who was one of the founders of the English Defence League, Breivik coming over to meet him to found this Knights Templar group in Britain back in 2002. But ultimately, Siobhan, what's your thoughts about this guy? Was he an evil man or was he mad?
Well, they've declared him sane. How sane anybody can be to willingly go out and slaughter, which is what he did, so many people for a political ideal is just that is insanity. I'm sorry, no rational person would actually do it. Now, you mentioned the word martyr, Robin, and Joan of Arc was a martyr. You know, she was a martyr for her cause. He's not a martyr. He's no better than a kamikaze pilot who's going in to kill himself to kill others. And it all comes back to people not willing to look after each other, not willing to accept that people are different. You know, we are all human beings. We are all one race. We ought to all get along together for the benefit of everyone, not start saying that one colour, creed, religion, whatever is better than the other, because that's not the case. Everyone has their own ideas, everyone has their own principles, and we ought to live and let live, to be honest.
Now, this is also, I mean, we're not a million miles away from the last topic, because Breivik himself was, and you know, maybe presumably still is, a Freemason. When he was first arrested, there are pictures of him up on the internet in his Masonic outfit, and if you want to go online, and I'll put a couple of them up on our webpage after the end of the programme, he is a Freemason too. So this is a really, I think, a very bothering aspect of all this. It seems, Robin, that maybe there's another type of terrorism to Al-Qaeda, and this looks like it.
Well, there is a right-wing terrorism, and I've no doubt whatsoever that across the world there are others like Breivik who as yet haven't had the courage, as they would see it, to do what he's done. I agree, he's not a martyr. The point I was making, he thinks he's a martyr for his cause. And, you know, Hitler thought he was a martyr for his cause. And the point is, these people are extremely dangerous, but they can only thrive in society when society is in a state of crisis where there isn't a usual way out for people in terms of jobs, homes and everything else. Racism is used in societies very often by ruling parties as a diversion away from the idea that there need to be struggles around social issues. And, you know, we've seen in the past in this country, and even occasionally, you know, at the present time, the race card being used, this idea that terrorism comes with the word Muslim attached to it. Let's be quite honest, terrorists who, you know, use violence in the way that Breivik did, or in the way that any organization does to fulfill a political end, You have to ask the question of why aren't they capable of reaching out to people with the strength of their political argument?
Well, I think one of the most important points you make there is this idea of when you have a really divided society, it's actually a sort of feeding ground for fascism. And on the topic of divided society, we've heard a few times on this show, Martin Summers mentions it quite a lot as well, is this book called The Spirit Level. And on the Tax Justice Network TaxCast, which is just out, which comes out once a month, which is all looking at tax and that kind of thing, this week the Spirit Level authors Kate Wilkinson and Stuart Pickett were on.
The measure we've used in our book is the difference between the incomes of the top 20% of the population and the bottom 20%. And in the most unequal countries we look at, like the UK and the USA and Portugal, the rich have incomes that are about 7 to 9 times those in the bottom fifth. Whereas in those more equal countries, the Scandinavian countries and Japan, the rich have incomes that are 3.5 to 4 times those of the poorest fifth.
More unequal societies have 10 times the homicide rates. The proportion of population in prison tends to be as much as 10 times as high in more unequal societies. Teenage pregnancy or mental illness and infant mortality are 2 or 3 times as high. It's not just one or two things that are affected by the scale of inequality, it's almost everything. Inequality has been a really important contributor to the financial crash of 1929, and so all the systems which have allowed inequality to increase have contributed to the present economic crises.
Well, there we are. That was the TaxCast about the Spirit Level, the authors of whom are Kate Wilkinson and Stuart Pickett, really, I suppose, underlining points we've been making, various points throughout this show, about inequality and its effect. I mean, 10 times as more homicides in unequal societies. Finally, then, The Pursuit of Julian Assange is an assault on freedom and a mockery of journalism. So says John Pilger this week. Siobhan, what's your thoughts about what's been going on after Assange's... it looks like he's going to be living permanently. I don't know if he's going to be coming out onto the balcony once a week to give us the latest WikiLeaks.
Well, you never know. He might give us a wave like the Queen. I mean, having been housebound previously isn't going to stop him. You know, he has produced a book. We've had documentaries. He's still going to be working on this. He's still going to be ensuring that we get to hear the things that, to be honest, in my belief, we should be hearing. They shouldn't be hidden under the carpet and hidden away because governments are too frightened to let the people know when they've really messed up.
So do you go along with this conspiracy theory that maybe the thing in Sweden
Look, the situation in Sweden, there are too many holes in it. And a woman who has been raped does not go out with the same person the following day and send tweets saying that they're with the best, most wonderful people in the world. Then she then goes and reports that she was raped the preceding night. Sorry, don't believe it.
I think the real issue with Julian Assange is that he is very worried, and rightly so, that if he goes to Sweden to answer these charges, the Swedish government will extradite him to the USA, because the Swedish government has never refused any extradition request from the US. And we all know that the US is gunning for Julian Assange and is not interested in a rape allegation, but is interested in putting him in prison because of the WikiLeaks that he's been involved in. And so, you know, the Swedish police should come to Britain to interview Julian Assange. None of us take rape claims lightly. They have to be investigated. However, you know, there are other dimensions to this case which mean that if Julian Assange were to leave the embassy, the next time we'd see him pop up, in my opinion, would be wearing an orange boiler suit in the USA, and he would then be hit with a whole series of charges, and that would be the end of Julian Assange for 25 years. It would be an attempt to intimidate WikiLeaks to close it down. We've seen the same with Bradley Manning. We've seen many other people in Britain and elsewhere threatened with extradition to the USA because they've broken the rules according to Obama, Bush and all the other presidents.
Siobhan, though, I want to give you the final word on this. I mean, what does this say for investigative journalism nowadays? Because many of the big stories over the last 4 years or so have been Assange's stories, and maybe some of the press here in Britain is a bit jealous of that.
Maybe they are, but they should maybe aspire to be like him. I mean, we know that Sweden is America's lapdog, and we need to ensure that he was never actually interviewed over the allegations. You know, he was he never got given the chance to say his
part. I'm going to have to stop you there. We're going to have a bit more about this towards the end of the next hour, but it's Murdoch News at 6 time. Thank you very much to this week's guest, Conservative Councillor for Avonmouth, Siobhan Kennedy-Hall.
The community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6. Anders Breivik has been jailed for up to 21 years.